Over the past few months, it has seemed that we have had our fair share of fear and uncertainty and anxiety surrounding us. I mean, we have heard of terrible natural disasters, rampaging floods and earthquakes, tsunamis, tornadoes, and those disasters, they ripple out when we're told of them again and again with no break in between. It taxes our compassion as we're asked to respond with our resources and especially our money. And then, of course, when we mention money, it brings up even more anxiety because we're still in the midst of a recession and every step of progress seems to be followed by two more steps back into it. And then we have a government that seems intent on playing one-upsmanship rather than effecting real and lasting change. And they barter and threaten with the well-being of others, seeking political points rather than the common good. And even locally, we might feel uncertain as Marcellus shale drilling rig is placed close to our drinking water supply. And there might or might not ever be a problem there, but a great deal of anxiety has been raised when people find out there's no mechanism for public comment or disclosure before permits are issued. And it all pops up all of a sudden. And then we're set against one another. When in the midst of a recession, we're told we have to choose between jobs and a safe environment. It does not take a very close inspection at all to see our life seems precariously balanced. And for many people, they live on the edge by either circumstance or poor management. Many, both people who live in or near poverty and those who don't, live paycheck to paycheck. And then, to top it all off, in terms of fear and uncertainty, I don't even want to go into all of the drama surrounding the WVU football team this year. Just past few months have been almost too much. When we look at the world around us, to say we are battered by rough seas of life might be an understatement. And so in these times, we might often turn to the church. And then we find discord and strife because there's uncertainty and fear there as well. The recession is taking grips in the church. Many congregations are scrambling to deal with lower giving. This one, not really so much, and we're very thankful for that. Many church bodies then are, the larger church bodies are struggling how to respond to the shortfalls. Well, the ELCA is preparing to meet in its churchwide assembly next week, August 15th through the 19th. And, you know, the budget that it's putting forward is calling to major reduction in vital ministries. The campus ministry, it will affect the Lutheran campus ministry here at WVU. The campus ministry is one of those areas. The proposed budget will cut 40% from campus ministry support. Talk to Chaplain Regal. Ask him why he's riding his motorcycle to Orlando. But you know, while it seems daunting, uncertainty for the church is nothing new. Routinely, the church has had to face fear and uncertainty. Even with Jesus around, the disciples found themselves fearful. Not only did Jesus' disciples have to fear the authorities, both political and religious, at times, it even seems like Jesus places them in a position to be afraid in and of itself. Today's gospel reading has the disciples being forced into a boat to go across the sea. I mean, a reading today said that Jesus made the disciples get into the boat while he dismissed the crowds. Well, the word there is really incredibly forceful. A forced or compelled works perhaps better. So, Jesus feeds the multitude, ships off his disciples, dismisses the crowds, and goes up the mountain to pray. Well, the disciples do not have an easy time in the boat. One translation could say that the boat is harassed by the waves. From evening until the early hours of the morning, the boat and the disciples struggle against the forces of nature. And then, more anxiety is raised when the disciples see a figure walking toward them. They believe it's a ghost and understandably are afraid. And yet, the figure greets them. And again, perhaps the translation doesn't do our reading justice. Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. Well, take not, fear not. Those are just fine. It's that middle part. When Jesus identifies himself, his statement actually says, I am. Theologian Stanley Hauerwas writes that just as God names himself to Moses in the burning bush, Jesus identifies himself as I am. This is the I am of Psalm 77. The I am who provides a way through the sea, a path through the mighty waters, leaving footprints unseen. End quote. Throughout this text, we hear of a close relationship between God and Jesus. What God does, Jesus does. Jesus' identity is linked with God in his greeting and in his actions. Jesus is shown having power over the realm of chaos that was deeply linked with the sea. Jesus is not thwarted from treading over the very things that harass the disciples. Jesus is Lord. Well, so then Peter calls out, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Now, Peter has a terrible reputation. He's brash, and he's bold, and he blurts things out. And in some ways here, he is no different. He gets a lot wrong. Mark Vitalis Hoffman, the New Testament professor at the Lutheran Seminary in Gettysburg, points out that Peter now joins the ranks of those who ask for proof of Jesus' identity. Satan, as he tempts Jesus, the high priest at Jesus' trial, and the mockers who surround the cross at the crucifixion. They all use the same question. If you are, Peter, if you are he, if you're the real Jesus, Satan says, if you're the Son of God, if you're the Messiah. Doesn't keep real good company there. But he's not a complete failure either. I mean, we might want to hear Jesus' words at the end, oh, you of little faith. That's sort of a complete and utter rebuke. But it's not. It sort of becomes Jesus' pet term for the disciples in general throughout the Gospel of Matthew. He uses it again and again, oh, you of little faith. And he's always talking to the disciples. But there's not a complete and utter lack of faith. I mean, Peter recognizes that if it is Jesus, he has the authority to command him to come to him. And so here, instead of being brash, as usual, he waits. Peter sees that the ability to come to Jesus only comes from Jesus himself. I mean, it's nothing he can do on his own initiative. So he waits. And he begins to see that faith is somehow deeply connected to obedience. Now, Peter does go out on the water and moves towards Jesus. And then, of course, being distracted and fearful of the wind and the waves, Peter begins to sink. Now, let's be clear. He does not sink and then become frightened. He becomes frightened and then begins to sink. And you know, and many commentators have pointed to this scene and said, oh, look, it's Peter. the rock which predictably sinks. Yeah, he takes his eyes off of Jesus. But he also recognizes that when he sinks, he can return and call upon Jesus. Lord, save me! He cries out. Well, that's Psalm 77, the one that talks about God who treads on the waters and leaves no footprints, opens with even more lines that help us connect to Jesus. Because the psalmist says, I cried out to God for help. When I was in distress, I sought the Lord. Peter's not perfect. But he's grasped something here. He is not irredeemable. He knows that Jesus will not forsake him. Christ called him out upon the water. So lesson number one there is, right, one, be careful what you ask God for. But then Jesus does not abandon him. Even when things get rough, even when doubt and uncertainty appear. It's a lot like that in the church today. The church is not the hierarchy that we might often think, those structures that surround us. But we, the church, the baptized children of God, we're like Peter. We don't get things right all the time. And God doesn't abandon us. It is noted by many that an early symbol of the church was the boat, the ship. Starts with the image of Noah and the ark. Moves to this symbol, the disciples in a boat. That boat saves us through water, moves through the powers of chaos and uncertainty. When buffeted by danger and insecurity, we are surrounded by salvation in a relationship to Jesus, the Son of God. But we have to remember that a boat's not meant to be anchored, moored up on the dock. Mark Vitalis Hoffman again reminds us that it is not a static symbol. It's a vehicle that's used to get somewhere. And where it's supposed to go is wherever Christ calls it. And that may mean for most of the church's life, we're meant to be far from shore, surrounded by wind and waves and danger and uncertainty. Our path may seem to go in uncertain waters, perhaps even to areas where we might risk death. But the church has been called the ark of the kingdom. Our task isn't just to survive. We don't cling to the hopes of life. Oh, let's just get through it. But our task is to be faithful witnesses. Fear cannot dominate our lives. We have work to do. The disciples had work to do. They were on their way across the sea to meet the people, to witness to who Jesus is. They had good work. We have good work to do. Good work in witnessing, in testifying, in worshiping Jesus. As the disciples did, Jesus enters the boat and they worship him. This worship, this witness, the disciples do after seeing Jesus and Peter in the water, leads us to order our lives in such a way that when Christ calls us, we are secure. No matter how much fear and anxiety and doubt and death surround us. We are given the grace to trust that the God who raised Jesus from the dead will watch over us as we step out in faith. We are called to step out in such a way that the world no longer determines our steps, but Christ does. We are called to step out in such a way that we witness that all those fears and storms and floods and disturbances of life do not define us. God does. And it is that God who will uphold us as we walk these seas of life. And throughout it all, this Lord, this Christ, this Son of God, Jesus is there for us, raising us up when we fall short, when he forgives our sins in the words of the absolution, strengthening us with his very body and blood. Thanks be to God.